Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
Okay, first thing, Brandon, recap the 76 pages of the Grant lawsuit.
Good to go.
All right, live from Wide Open here on Spadina on a very rainy Saturday afternoon. We have renamed this. It is now, after Wade got some backlash to this, this is now the first of an annual tradition. It is the Wrestling Media Summit.
Summit instead of state. Okay, yes.
The state of wrestling media drew some pushback from us. We are not going to be solving all of wrestling media's woes in this next hour. Maybe Benno has all the answers, but we are joined by an esteemed panel, an international panel, people that have flown over oceans to attend this, people that have driven across the border Rivers. To get here. So let's first go around the horn, starting with Stephanie Chase. And I want to get everyone just like a quick synopsis of how long you've been involved in wrestling media and some of the outlets for people that might not know who these voices are.
Oh, hello, everyone. I've been involved in wrestling media for about, I'd say, 6 or 7 years. 5 years of that were spent working at Digital Spy in the UK. Now I'm kind of on my own. Yeah.
Converted Torontonian.
Yes, I am now in Toronto. I've been here since March. Joined the Canadian Wrestling Media Alliance, or what do you call yourselves?
The Canadian Media Alliance, that could be our unofficial organization.
I'll start that up.
Our next two guests, if I'm not mistaken, do we have two people here with cage match profiles, beginning with you, Beto?
Oh, yeah, that's true, yeah. I think Brandon's is going to be a bit more detailed than mine
profile?
Is. Yeah, I don't think mine's got my podcast on it either, I was going to say, to answer the question of how long I've been wrestling media. Do you count being a dickhead on Twitter? Because if you do, we're going back a couple of decades.
For some people, that is a prerequisite.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. I'm not so active on there anymore. But yeah, about 2016, 2017 is when I started writing and yeah, podcasting, obviously, for you guys back with the old British Audio Wrestling days, into Indie Corner and Grapple. So yeah, been around a while.
And we go to Brandon Thurston. When do you feel you made the conversion to wrestling media and your involvement with WrestleNomics in its various incarnations?
Yeah, I guess around 2015, I started writing for Voices of Wrestling. When I was like 17, I was aggregating like just translated Japanese wrestling news. But that's way back and after a long break. But yeah, so I wrote for Voices of Wrestling for a while. I wrote for Fightful, for Wrestling Inc. There might be others in there. But then I really started to do WrestleNomics 2017 and forward.
I remember, actually, my first introduction was I had first seen the name Brandon Howard Thurston, yes, as the byline on Fightful. And I went to, I think it was UFC 207,
oh, yes,
maybe, in Buffalo.
In Buffalo, yeah.
And
right after WrestleMania.
There was somebody I saw there that in my head, I'm like, that must be Brandon Thurston.
Oh,
it was,
wow,
definitely not you. And we did not meet, I think, that particular weekend. But
okay,
that was my first introduction where I thought I had seen this person who I had started reading, and you did not have your profile picture. I think it was like, what was your Twitter avatar? Was it like John Pesek or someone? Or
Farmer Burns, probably.
Farmer Burns was,
yes,
the one that you had. And so I didn't even know what you looked like at that time. That was like 2017. Mm-hmm. And then we get to the esteemed Wei Ting, and I mean, you have an interesting path of how you've got to wrestling media.
Yes, through one John Pollock, I suppose. I mean, I worked, I guess I had already decided on a career in the media, and then a little place called the Fight Network decided to open up, and I got my first internship, and I guess that was sort of my introduction into what you would consider the wrestling media through, I guess, years of podcasting and affiliation with Live Audio Wrestling, of course, and a lot of... a lot of hours, I guess, spent watching and discussing this stuff. I suppose I am a member of the wrestling media.
And how has your role changed from your work at the Fight Network to like post wrestling now for 6 years? Because I've seen like a big change in like what you're doing, and I would say like how has that switch been?
Yeah, I guess that now I'm a lot more responsible for sort of like the tone of like, you know, a media source, and the sort of aesthetics, and I would just say overall direction of the content. You know, obviously partnering with you, but it's definitely elevated my role from just maybe somebody who's creating it to somebody who's more of a curator of sorts.
And I guess quickly for me, I started working with Live Audio Wrestling, which was a radio show out of Toronto. I worked on their web content. They also worked with a number of wrestlers, including Chris Benoit. So I was actually responsible for Chris Benoit's newsletter for a period of time, which looks odd on the resume. But then I started as a call screener, pretty much just volunteering my time, and slowly became the board operator, a producer, a co-host, and just holding all of those roles until 2017, and that's when we were let go by the Fight Network and launched Post Wrestling in December of that last year. So that's kind of an introduction for all of us. But let's dive in, because this specific year of 2024 seems to be one where there's more of a spotlight on the media's handling, because we have a lot of significant stories. I don't think anything bigger than the Janelle Grant lawsuit this year. How do you feel, Brandon, just in the last number of years, wrestling media has evolved, if at all, and how confident you feel in where things are at present day, knowing that I think there's still a lot of improvements to make, but are you kind of happy at what you've seen this year, or do you still look for more?
I think in the last couple of years, we've seen kind of more people break news, if that's like, I guess that's part of what we're talking about when we talk about wrestling media. Fightful has become one of the biggest, maybe the biggest news breaker. But as far as like what I think wrestling media's one of its best functions, if not the best function, is to report and make transparent information that will help everybody understand what's happening in the business and will hopefully make it better. Has that improved in recent times? I don't know. It's probably about the same as it's ever been.
For you, Benno, you guys were so closely tied just geographically to the whole speaking out movement. Mm-hmm. And that was like an incredibly difficult period. How would you contrast that in 2020 to this year and reporting on a lot of, and really over the last 2 years when the NDAs have come to light regarding Vince McMahon? Do you see a lot of parallels? Do you see differences in how one was covered versus the other?
Yeah, there's a lot of similarities. Like speaking out was kind of its own beast just because of the time. It took place during the height of the pandemic. You know, a lot of people had a lot of time on their hands, and I almost think that story only broke because of that time, and it became as big as it did because of that, because there were so many people covering it. And it kind of goes to the conversation about wrestling media, and that a lot of that was driven by Twitter accounts and, you know, other more unofficial ways of kind of reporting some of those stories and such. But it was taken with a gravity, and that was good. And then you compare it to kind of today and the Vince McMahon, the WWE, Janelle Grant situation, and you do wonder if lessons have been learned. And I think it is easy, maybe easier now, for people to maybe compartmentalize those stories and give them lip service and, you know, go back to the fun stuff. Whereas I think in that time during speaking out, there wasn't much else going on. So it became, you know, a headline. It was unavoidable to cover. You know, you guys did a great job covering it. Most of the major publications covered it in all seriousness, and you have that now with the Vince McMahon Janelle Grant case, but I think it's almost lip service, I think, for some, and not taken with the gravity I would say it requires.
And for you, Stephanie, in your 6 to 7 years of covering this, do you think that it's in a better place than when you entered this industry, and what are, you know, some of the issues that are kind of top of mind for you at the moment when it comes to like just day-to-day coverage, and especially the more serious stuff and how well or not properly they're being handled?
I think it's in a slightly better place. I think speaking out I found really interesting because it was, for me, the first time that I saw wrestling take seriously those issues. And I think a lot of that was because of the pandemic, as Benno said, and people having like more time to look at it. But I think as we've gone on a couple more years from that, I'm not sure that all the lessons have been learned, because I don't think things have got that much better. And we saw that, I think, with the initial Vince McMahon accusations, how long it took people to decide to really take that seriously and get rid of Vince McMahon. It wasn't really until the Janelle Grant lawsuit. And I think you still see stuff even now that is in the realm of speaking out that is just kind of brushed aside, or people don't take seriously, or people even looking back at some of the stuff that happened during speaking out and being like, well, actually, maybe we could just enough time has moved on and invite this person back in, you know. So I do think it's improved, but I do think since the pandemic, there have been a lot more people entering wrestling media that don't necessarily have any media or journalistic training whatsoever. And that might be from the pandemic of more people being at home, being on Twitter, being able to do writing. That I do sometimes think affects how wrestling media works and what people see as important in their role as in covering wrestling.
I think that's always something I look at and kind of struggle with, is that this is not an industry that is necessarily one you go into school with the direction that I'm going to cover wrestling. It's usually born out of, you begin as a fan and then you graduate into reporting on some level, whether it be the major outlet, your own personal space. And I think it's very important that, you know, when you're covering especially the severity of these stories, that it's kind of like that demarcation line of like, fandom was, it's great that you have that background knowledge and understanding, but in the reporter role, like, you do kind of have to separate the two. There needs to be that hard line. And for some, it's like they are servicing an audience that wants the fantasy. They want like kind of the happier stories in wrestling. And I think it all comes down to, who are you providing information and who is your audience?
And for the individuals as well, I think it's just, and we saw it in speaking out, people just want to watch wrestling. When you have a media that's made up of people who were fans, they just want to enjoy it, don't they? They want to compartmentalize the bad stuff and just get back to enjoying what's on TV and enjoying the wrestling. You see people kind of, as you've seen, Steph, you know, make arguments with themselves and agreements with themselves on what they're willing to accept so that they continue to enjoy their wrestling. And I think that bleeds through to some people's work, and that bleeds through to the audience that they're serving. I don't know if you're going to say the same thing.
Well, I was just going to say, like, wrestling is so niche that it does take, like, the most hardcore fans to think that I'm going to dedicate my time to this, like, my work time. And because there's not really jobs that make big money in wrestling media, like, After I studied journalism, my first thing was interning at a fashion magazine, right? And there was like such a clear path there to work at the magazine, make loads of money. And then, you know, I went on to doing entertainment journalism. But with wrestling, like, you have to be like the most hardcore fan. And I think that there are some people, and it almost feels like mean to say it, but like, they are just fans, they've got a bit of a following, and then they end up getting like invited to events as media, as press, and it's almost like a fan badge of honor rather than a actual someone working in a badge of honor. There's a lot of like, congratulations, you made it, in a fan way rather than a serious working journalist way.
Yeah. And I think it's something we talk about a lot, Brandon, is that I think like that's not an insignificant percentage of the fan base too, that I don't think they want to watch their product of choice with a guilty conscience. And it has been remarkable to see how we look at January and what that lawsuit shined a light on. And yet this company has not skipped a beat all year. In fact, they are at their hottest period in decades.
In years, yeah. I guess I think wrestling media is not going to change as long as the incentives are what they are, in terms of where does the money come from in wrestling media. A lot of it comes from news aggregators who rely on impressions and clicks so that generates ad revenue for them. Or there's some YouTube channels that have interviews with talent or with recognizable names in the business, and those generate a lot of views and in turn generate a lot of ad revenue. I think what we've seen, maybe we should talk about Patreon. Like, Patreon has changed the incentives a little bit in terms of, it's not, If you're selling subscriptions, it's not just about getting the most attention that you can possibly get and getting people to look at you, but it's actually giving them something that is special and that they can't get elsewhere. And I would say in Fightful's case, that's resulted in them reporting a lot of new information, insider news that people are paying for, much like people paid for over the years, The Observer, The Torch. But as long as, like, you know, the incentives don't directly tie into, like, doing what I would like to think we've done since the beginning of the year, in that reporting on information that people don't necessarily want reported. I'm still, if I'm selling subscriptions, I'm still incentivized to do things and maintain relationships so that people will talk to me and that my relationships will stay intact and I'll be able to break news. That doesn't necessarily incentivize me to report on bad stuff that should be reported. What was the original question?
How do you find, like, the Patreon model works, building off what Brandon stated, and kind of what the incentive model is for a lot of sites, where if it is website revenue that's driving things, or YouTube impressions versus something that's more of a subscription base? Like, do you see a difference there that in terms of?
So I think Patreon originally started off as not just maybe a place to sell subscriptions. I think it started off as a sort of a crowdfunding, you know, platform with similar sort of aims as like a Kickstarter or a GoFundMe even, I guess, but more specific to, like, you know, work. In time, I mean, inevitably, something like that is going to maybe lean more towards the subscription-based side of things. And, you know, I think wrestling, a niche like wrestling media and wrestling news kind of falls in an awkward space between, like, hard news and entertainment. And when you're talking about entertainment, you kind of have to provide value in a bit of a different way from, like, just say, like, I don't know, a New York Times or something like that. But even, like, a New York Times has to kind of skew some of its coverage towards, like, what might be attractive behind a paywall. But I just think I think there are a lot of expectations for wrestling media, and I think everybody just kind of has different ideas of how they want to present their own content, and they all have different audiences that I think, you know, expect their content presented in catered towards in different ways.
Yeah, it's kind of where I make the analogy of looking at, you know, like, wrestling media can be so many different things. It's like looking at the entirety of a newspaper and all the different sections. Like, there is going to be your investigative reporters. There's also going to be your more lighthearted, like, a theater critic that might not be equipped to be covering, like, the biggest, you know, scandals in a case. So it's like, I'm not too judgmental when it comes to people that know their audiences and such. But I think, like, there's few stories in our lifetime that are going to be of the significance that if you were to survey 100 people of who was the most powerful person in pro wrestling's history, you're getting one answer. And that person resigned in disgrace this year amid horrific allegations. And to me, that is something that, you know, we have some hindsight now of 6 months to look back at how the story has gone down, how this company was completely untouched by this scandal. And, like, listen, they did a very strategic campaign of the new era and separating ourselves, even though this company is still a defendant in this lawsuit. And I think it is a struggle for some people on how to cover this and for stories to continue on beyond just the requisite coverage when it happens, and then we move on to the next story. I don't think this is one of those stories you just move on to and we give our 2 week lip service to attention and then forget about it.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's the thing as well. We see it on a micro level, don't we, when we're trying to do our shows, and you have, you know, like you said there, people have got different reasons for being and different reasons that outlets exist. And, you know, we will do shows where the primary focus is supposed to be a review of a pay-per-view, but something new in the Vince McMahon Janelle Grant case drops and you have to cover that, and it's always awkward leading with that and then moving on to the more lighthearted story.
Right.
And I think sometimes when people find that uncomfortable, that just means, okay, well, the more serious story either gets pushed to the end of the show or doesn't get covered on the show, and that's why you see that happen. Like, it is a difficult thing to bridge, isn't it, to do both those things? And, yeah, I think as responsible people covering this industry, I think you've got to do both. You know, for Grapple, like, if anything drops on that story, and we take you guys as a great example of it, it's always the lead story. It has to be the lead story. How can it not be the lead story? Imagine explaining to anybody on the outside, you know, who doesn't know our little wrestling industry, that it isn't, you know, the thing that we're all talking about at all times. And while it's understandable that's the case, I think a lot of the responsibility of making sure that's front and center lies in the wrestling media's hands and the people covering wrestling in general.
But it isn't a good like example of that weirdness of wrestling media, like how these scrums are like for both companies, because no one can decide whether they're real or not, or whether they're serious or not. So like with WWE and with AEW as well, it seems to be like a fight between people saying, well, you should ask the serious hard questions at this, and then other people saying, well, like, that's not fair because it's just like a little post-show thing. And wrestling, like, in that sense, can never decide what it wants to be. And I always find, like, when I'm explaining to other journalists I know that did not choose professional wrestling, like, how if I say, like, I'm preparing for an interview with some wrestler today, I'm sitting there thinking, well, I need to, like, think of questions where if this wrestler goes fully kayfabe, I can get something out of it. Or if they're being themselves, I can get something out of it. Like, you don't even know in those situations when you're going into what you have to get. And that's why, like, wrestling media is so completely weird. Like, there is no consensus on what we are, how we're covering it, like, at all. Like, you don't get in other industries.
Yeah. Go ahead, Brett. I guess I think there's, in the case of a press conference, like the one that we'll attend tonight, hopefully, there's interviewing talent, and I think that's a different, more lighthearted story. But when you have a chance to ask a question to Paul Levesque or Tony Khan, who are two of the probably three most influential and most powerful people in the business, I think there is a higher priority to. Like, I don't expect to ask LA Knight to tell me about unionization, LA Knight. I don't expect him to have the freedom to speak freely on topics like that, or on, you know, sexual misconduct in the workplace. But when you have a chance to ask that question to Paul Levesque the night of the Royal Rumble, 2 days after the Grant case has been filed, I do think all the questions should be about that. And we want to be like non-judgmental about everybody being able to, you know, do their own kind of content or whatever. But like, what happens when we're sharing space with people who are not willing to ask those questions? Like, there were five questions, I think, to Paul Levesque after the Royal Rumble, but only three out of the five were about the Grant case. One was about the Netflix deal. One was about, is this era as good as the Attitude Era or not? And
we might not have time to get to that today, but we'll try.
Yeah. So if that sounds judgmental to say you shouldn't be asking that question, I guess, sorry. But like, I think that is, you know, that's a failure to bring to the industry what it would be better off to have brought to it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I certainly, like, these press conferences, like, in some ways, they are what the media in attendance make them to be. Like, I always look at it that, you know, if this is a press conference, then that means that Paul Levesque or Tony Khan or whoever, they can control the answers, but the questions they cannot control.
And they also control who gets credentialed, and they also control who gets called on.
That is, like, there's a certain level of control there. But when it is presented as almost, and Brandon, you've like given a lot of insight to this, is that the way it's structured, and whether this is intentional or it's just a byproduct of the presentation, is that it's typical that a WWE press conference is an hour.
Goal.
England have scored. They just, I'm not very patriotic. I'm not celebrating.
That person was just excited about my question that I was going to ask. But, you know, typical, it's like 3 to 4 guests, all winners on the show. They won a championship. It's something significant in their career. And it's a celebratory atmosphere. And then Paul Levesque comes in. And it's almost like if you, after 45 minutes of kind of a rah-rah setting, it's suddenly you put a very heavy topic in there. Like, you're the guy that's bringing the mood down.
Absolutely.
And that's whether by strategy or that's just how things have turned out. That is the setting primarily in a WWE press conference, but it goes to AEW too. And I think that there is a certain level to that. There's also like media here who are their voices on camera. It's like, it's in some ways like you are performing for an audience that's going to be very critical of you. And thus we get these press conferences, but it's like, it's half press conference, half pep rally. And I think it's like, it depends on sort of who is asking questions and what it becomes. And
I've seen that at all levels as well, even going to like WXW shows in Europe. and you'll get, you know, Matt Riddle comes out and he's talking about his match and breaking it down in completely non-kayfabe terms, and then they wheel out his opponent, who's then talking about the match. They just had like it was a shoot fight, and you're in that position as a media member, almost want to like put your hand up and go like, so did you guys just have a shoot fight there? Like, what were we watching in that case? And it's that blurred line and that problem that we have at that low level, but in WWE and in AEW, where there is no decision on whether this is in character or not. I think the best example of it is, and obviously it's not as serious a subject as the Vince McMahon case, but obviously the famous, you know, CM Punk promo slash, you know, the blow up. Like, he sat there on stage giving the media in attendance the biggest news story of the year to that point. You know, and it's happening right in front of them with the right people in the room to follow up on that. CM Punk leaves the room. We wheel out a couple of wrestlers, and what's the next question? Oh, Swerve Strickland and, you know, and Keith Lee, in your kayfabe story, you know, well, how did that match go? Or do you think you guys can coexist next? I can't remember the exact question, but it was a switch immediately to a safe, kayfabe-friendly question when everybody in that room should have been following up with Tony Khan, who was sat there on stage with very serious questions about what they just saw.
And the wrestlers that came out that were backstage that witnessed
Yeah,
it.
What did you see? You
what
know,
did you see?
What's happened?
Hey, Jericho, what did you just tell Tony Khan? Yeah. Like, and that was wild.
What a missed opportunity. And I don't know whether that is the way they're set up, or like you said, everybody in the room has just witnessed a very uncomfortable thing, and everybody wants to get in that comfortable space again. But watching from home, you're thinking that's not your job. Your job is to follow up on this and drill in on this and get Tony Khan in the moment. Imagine that. You're looking at him right there. It's like having, you know, Vince McMahon in front of you after the Montreal Screwjob, or after Bret Hart's just punched him out backstage, and you could ask him a question there and then, and that gets lost to history.
Hey, it's Sean Nelson, founder and CEO of Lovesac and host of the Let Me Save You 25 Years podcast. Want to skip the trial and error so you can head straight to success? Join me and incredible guests like Olympic legend Sean White and NFL superstar Rob Gronkowski as we share the lessons and mistakes that shaped our journeys. Ready to save yourself 25 years? Tune in on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. That's Let Me Save You 25 Years with Sean Nelson. Listen now.
If people are dieting now more than ever before, then why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that, instead of turning into fat when you consume it, turns into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. So, by getting more MCTs in your diet, you essentially flip a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which can flush out excess fat and calories. And he's created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it's a delicious drink. I love how incredible it tastes. All you do is add a scoop to water, enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized. So, if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to GundryMD.com/energy and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's GundryMD.com/energy.
When you need to work quickly and confidently, you need Grammarly. It's a trusted AI writing partner that helps you get work done faster with better writing. And it works where you work, across 500,000 apps and websites. 96% of users agree Grammarly helps them craft more impactful writing. Get AI writing support that works where you work. Sign up and download for free at Grammarly.com/podcast. That's Grammarly.com/podcast. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Wait, what differences do you observe from seeing like the AEW settings versus the WWE ones when it comes to the press conferences and the dichotomy between a Paul Levesque in that role and a Tony Khan?
Well, I'm starting to notice that AEW press conferences are becoming a bit more similar and streamlined to the WWE ones. And I think that's just simply because they've realized they've gone on too long, especially after these marathon, you know, pay-per-views. So I think in terms of content, I feel like the WWE ones are a little bit more maybe directed, and maybe there's a bit more pressure to, I think, you know what, I would say they're actually kind of similar, although I do feel like in AEW, I wouldn't just say things are straight up serious, because you have Toni Storm come out, and pretty much at this point, and every single press conference deliver like a scene, a skit. In WWE press conferences, you'll have Roman Reigns, you know, playing fully character, and telling the audience to stand for him, and things like that. Damian Priest, you know. So I would say they're largely similar, and I think they're largely dictated perhaps either by the performers themselves. When we're talking about Paul Levesque and Tony Khan, I think Paul Levesque has his script. You know, he'll come out, announce, like, spend 15 minutes announcing all of the, just the press release of, like, you know, the success of the thing. Then he'll, like, take a few questions. Whereas Tony Khan will sit there and I think has a bit more of a looser format. He'll accept, I guess, for the most part, questions from anybody who wants to ask for a lengthier amount of time. But I would say they're both trying to find their tone still at the moment, as are the media in trying to figure out what exactly these things are, expectations from the audience for what these things are supposed to be, how they're monetizing these things, and what exactly is the reason why, you know, this is beneficial for them to do a press conference like that. It's all part of, I think, the sort of awkward, I want to say maturation of the wrestling industry, where we're trying to, at the same time, be this weird entertainment source, but at the same time be like almost a serious, like, professional company that deals accordingly with media that covers it.
I think WWE do a better job with that separation that you were talking about. Like, Triple H comes out at the end, and then it's like more serious time. Tony Khan should not be sitting there the entire time. He should not be sitting there, especially after we saw the CM Punk thing happen. That was real. And then he's sitting there when these angles now happen in the press conference. I think when AEW started, they wanted to do something real. They wanted to do something sports-like, and they realized how hard / impossible that is totally in wrestling. But I do think it's very interesting how both Triple H and Tony Khan, when they've had their hardest, like, worst moments of worst questions, have been completely unprepared by their team, by the people that work for them. Triple H was completely not prepared to talk about the Janelle Grant lawsuit. He wasn't obviously prepared for the question that came about Drew Gulak. Tony Khan was not prepared at World's End, made an absolute fool of himself. And it was at that point that then the AEW pressers, I thought, changed even more, because then they brought out Renee to kind of guide them. And hearing things about, like, both those situations, I am totally shocked that two actual companies with professional people around them did not brief their heads in any way to take difficult questions on these things. And they've both, I mean, the person that's come out best in any serious situation is probably Cody Rhodes, and he's a wrestler, you know?
Yeah. I think the parallels are interesting between WWE and AEW, in that nobody is making these companies do these events in the first place. There's clearly a want from the people in charge to be like any other sport and to be taken seriously. Well, we should have, you know, some kind of media access. We should have media events. And I think both Paul Levesque and Tony Khan seem wired similarly in wanting that. But then, as wrestling people and as time goes on, there does become more of a want for the, well, the you know, the members of the media and the audience can be essentially extras, and we can maybe work this a little bit more, and we can,
they,
you know,
both
dodge
want
those serious
questions. The praise and the claps and the pats on the back.
Absolutely. Tony Khan just wants to talk.
Absolutely, Tony. Yeah.
As does Paul Levesque, though. And I think, yeah, there's nobody making them do this, but there's clearly a want to do it. But they, that's often wrestling people, as, you know, someone with a longer cage match history than me, Brandon, can attest to. They want their cake and they want to eat it too.
Yeah. I think Tony grew up reading the wrestling media. Paul Levesque clearly you know, evident from his interaction with Lucas Cherpiot, he has a disdain for the wrestling media. But I think, yeah, I think Tony wants to sit next to talent. He wants it to be known that it's him running the show and he's there endorsing this talent who just had a big moment in their career or something like that. I think there's a big difference between the professionalism that I think and the machine that you see when you're at a W press conference, and that, like, it starts right after the event, as opposed to in AEW. I feel a little bit like they take our time for granted and let us sit there for like a half an hour until, because Tony has to be there.
They did a post-show.
Most recently.
Yeah, they did Renee and RJ doing a post-show in front of us. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah. And it kind of feels to me like I'm just a fan waiting. And when everybody walks in, we're all going to clap and applaud like we're a bunch of fans. And making us sit there for 20 to 30 minutes. Whereas in WWE, everyone's kind of like rushed in there. You know, everybody's guided by, you know, somebody from PR rushing us in there, sit down, and it starts right away. It feels very much like this. Oh, this is a much bigger company, that it's a much bigger machine. And this is a company that is, you know, it's AEW, and we're all waiting for the boss to be done so he can be present for this. But yeah, this, you have something to add more about press conferences or?
Well, I mean, getting away kind of from the press conferences and on to kind of your next tier of media. And that would be like, Your sports business outlets, yes, that cover especially WWE, but AEW too, but it's a lot of, you know, business deals that they are making, generally pretty positive towards the company. And I think to the average fan, I think there's a lot more scrutiny at our level than it is to, yeah, that level, that do have resources, that do have staffs, that you look at when it comes to is there coverage of the negative. And I think for Paul Levesque, for instance, I think when he is diving into the tougher subjects that are brought to him, I think it's that concern that we don't want bad publicity. It's like we can stomach wrestling level coverage that is critical, but when it graduates to a sports business journal, a Puck, an ESPN, that is not what we are. That is the media we care about. And that's been a level that I think does deserve some criticism, yes, too. It's not as though wrestling is off limits for these outlets. They cover them, but it is sometimes very selective.
Yeah. As we discussed recently, I think that's the real story, is that, sure, there's wrestling media, and we talk to wrestling fans, a relatively small number of the public who will ever see any of our work. But when it comes to mainstream media outlets, they reach a far larger portion of the public with far greater credibility. They have far greater resources to do this sort of investigative work. They have a far stronger brand that will, you know, that will encourage people to actually talk to them and respond to the requests for comment. And when it comes to sports media outlets in particular, who I think Nick Khan happens to have a very strong relationship with, and who, including Sports Business Journal and other outlets, they have their events, and sort of the people that they're covering are also their customers. They want WWE to attend the Sports Business Journal conference and things like that and pay to get in. So I think there's a lot of conflict there. And what they do speaks not only to members of the public, barely speaks to wrestling fans, but most importantly, it speaks to sponsors, other business partners, media partners, who are the ones who actually contribute the money that matters. Unfortunately, this is not a business about ticket sales anymore. It's a business about media rights and sponsorships, and ticket money that used to be the lifeblood of this business decades ago is just sort of incidental now. And I think there's been a failure by the sports media, by the mainstream media, maybe apart from the Wall Street Journal, to cover the wrestling business with the attention that it deserves following at least the scandal surrounding Vince.
And it seems like, wait, it's this protective area, especially that we have seen that professional wrestling, it drives volume enough that it is worthy of coverage at a lot of these outlets, but it's not significant enough that it's inescapable of still kind of covering it tongue-in-cheek, that it's like this is still the circus, and it's through that lens that you see coverage, even when it's a significant case and you tune into CNN and they're making a quip about Vince McMahon in the most serious of allegations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, I think it's just part of like wrestling's continued adolescent phase, where it feels like we're still, you know, trying to get out of its reputation as like this very niche, almost like sideshow type of like circus. You know, like it'd be similar, I think, to a lot of coverage about I don't know, like maybe rap music, like in the mainstream, or like other smaller industries that typically are kind of met with, I don't know, a bit more judgment and color rather than like, you know, hard news. I don't know if we'll ever grow out of that, you know, like the for the most part, like so many people that are in charge of like these bigger outlets, when you look at professional wrestling, it's going to look that much sillier in comparison to, let's say, politics, you know, and things like that. But I do think like among the younger audiences, I do think that perception might be changing on a very small level, but is it going to change significantly so that we don't get those headlines by the time we're, I don't know, 60, 70? I'm not really that confident about that.
SmackDown, the term, has just been the bane of my existence, but for headline writers, they have gotten more than their use out of it of the past 25 years. Stephanie, being the lone female here on the panel, not to put you on the spot, but I want to know kind of what your experience is like on a day-to-day basis with just online like feedback you get. I try my best to like stay away from any and all feedback. I've tried to learn as much as I can from Brandon, but what is that experience like for you? Because I imagine it's different than what we encounter, perhaps. And has it gotten better?
Has it gotten better? It hasn't gone better. It gotten better since I've been harsher towards AEW. I'll say that. Like the AEW guy fans seem angrier to me than the WWE ones. I noticed from when I started, like one of the first things I ever did on camera and stuff was wrestling daily for WrestleTalk, and that's like very mainstream, very like young audience. And I think that was the worst period of my life as far as negative comments, just people, guys just not thinking that you know what you're talking about at all, or that you seriously watch this or have any background in that, and that's something I find in general when I turn up to places and start working with new people, like in the industry or PR people, especially when I worked for Digital Spy. It just seemed assumed that I was assigned this rather than that this was like literally, in that case, a job I created for myself.
There's a perception placed on you.
Yeah, that like, oh, this girl's just been assigned to cover this wrestling event or whatever. But yeah, I think that's the hardest part about the negativity. But also then when you start talking about things like Vince McMahon speaking out, individual wrestlers that have accusations, I think then it gets even worse, because it becomes like this woman is just trying to like tear down all these men, that like this woman just cares about this, like shut up about all these like, you know, women's issues, and I think that like that's the hardest part. I think when, and it's certainly this year, this past couple of months, with some of the stuff that's happened or some of the stuff I've said online, it's been a lot of, yeah, like this woman is just like being jealous to tear down men and like burn men, rather than just trying in any way to hold this industry accountable that has been behind when it comes to like sexism for like decades. I mean, even on screen, we know how long it took for a women's revolution, but in all ways it is so behind, because I watch and listen to a lot about other forms of media where it seems people have much more open conversations about sexism, diversity, and things like that than in wrestling. It feels more like people just like, no, like shut up and watch the wrestling, it's fine.
Is that something that when you're working on a story or putting something out, is the reception you're going to receive, is that something you're actively thinking about when it comes to just past experiences and things like that? Or do you kind of just compartmentalize and not think about, just I'm going to do my work and whatever the reaction is?
I do think about that, and then I end up doing it anyway, and then I can get kind of overwhelmed and upset about things that, I mean, I brought it on myself because I did say that thing that people are giving me backlash about. But it is something, yeah, I do think about it. It hasn't stopped me from doing anything, but I think some of this stuff can be like particularly nasty. Like, I don't have an experience of being a man doing it, but I know with when you're a woman doing it, like, they pick out other things about you that are, like, nothing to do with your work to have a go at you about when they're just trying to defend their favorite wrestler or their favorite company.
Yeah, I can speak to that in that we had a run-in with a British wrestling promoter, and you wrote a piece about what happened in that incident, and the piece was mainly about my conversation with that wrestling promoter and the feedback and the, I suppose, abuse that you got compared to what I got as the person who was, you know, mostly involved in that conversation was night and day. You know, the DMs, the types of things people were saying to you, like, it was a complete different world. And that was me and you in that same situation, having that same lived experience. It was something about being female that attracts them.
Don't say that unless you're going to wear a turtleneck, because
I mean, when you, Brandon, kind of look at like what we got to, you know, hear firsthand from Lucas Sharpio, like, I look at that as, here's someone that goes to this press conference, asks what I thought was like a pretty relatively, like, this was not like the wildest question that you could have imagined, and here's someone 21 years of age that is getting death threats, and I think that, like, I don't know how I would necessarily handle that at 21 versus like 40, where you're just more equipped, I think, to be able to kind of handle that and, you know, just to deal with it. But I think overall, like, there's a tone that if you're a young reporter and you see what someone like that goes through after a question, you maybe are thinking twice about being in that setting. And it's like, I could ask this question. I could also preserve my sanity for the next 2 weeks and not be threatened with my life.
I think we had a conversation with him along those lines after he went to Clash at the Castle in Glasgow. I mean, that's whether or not that's the intention, and the wrestling executives are rubbing their hands together and thinking, yeah, we want to create these sort of emotional deterrents for people so that they don't ask challenging questions or not, whether that's the intent or not. I mean, that's something that happens. But we need to ask those questions anyway.
Yeah, and I think that that's unfortunately something that I think anyone that is kind of doing this, like, you are going to go through that kind of thing. And I think it's just, I don't know, my rule is just, like, I don't look at my mentions. I don't, like, obviously I'm going to see stuff here and there, but it's like, I don't look for the positive messages, and therefore I don't look for the negative messages. So it's like, you can't do one and the other. You can't just try and take in all the positive stuff and then negate the negative. It's like, if you give no weight to either, I think that's maybe the healthiest way to do it. And there's a lot of, like, great feedback you can get from people. I think it's important to have constructive feedback, but I think it just becomes harder and harder to parse that when you're navigating what is not always constructive criticism that you're getting online. Do you have any, like, thought on just how you deal with, like, online criticism that maybe comes from your some opinion you put in?
You know, as always, the nature of what we do in particular is criticizing other people for their work. So I always remain, like, I always try to see if the source of the criticism is in good faith, or if it's just, I mean, if it's a personal attack or if it's something else, I try to completely ignore that. But I do try to at least, you know, try to keep a bit of an open mind to see whether or not there's any validity to the comment, even the ones that are a bit more vile. Like, is there something behind this that I think is valid? But for the most part, like, you know, as any sort of content creator, I think you have to understand that it's sort of part of the game. It's part of having an audience, and you know, to do your best to maybe ignore, like, the bad noise, maybe filter in the genuine responses from your audience that's out there, and to just kind of, you know, put your head down and, like, continue to do your best. To me, that's the best way of addressing criticism, is by continuing to deliver good work that you're proud of.
We'll start to wind this down and just kind of go around. I want to ask you, Brandon, what you feel today is the toughest part of your job, and what are some of your goals with WrestleNomics, especially over this last year, where I think you have been at the forefront of a lot of the stuff that we've been talking about today?
I don't know. There's a lot of technical things that are part of my job that are not about, like, the traditional reporting part. I guess I always come to these, like, ethical issues that I always go to you about, in that there's, you know, I didn't go to school for journalism, you know, but I went to school for philosophy, which I think is helpful.
Yeah.
Because there's been, I don't know how many times just this year where like, I've been like, oh, we're kind of at this dilemma here. We're like, is it actually right to do this? The example I brought up recently is when we reported that Janelle Grants, one of her PR representatives, was a former Trump communication aide. And is the Trump connection between the McMahons and Trump enough to that we have a responsibility to report that? I felt we did. So like, that's just one thing that's, I think, like uniquely challenging, and that like reasonable people could probably disagree about and come to different conclusions about goals for WrestleNomics. I guess it's getting close
to
like
ratings from Netflix.
Ratings. Yes, we need Nielsen to cover Netflix viewership. I guess it's becoming more of a more similar in terms of income to my full-time job. I still have a full-time job. Is, you know, as the years go by, it's getting closer and closer, and maybe it'll be I'll be able to quit my day job someday, but we'll see. I guess my goal every day is to report things that hold the business to account, and I think that this business in particular has a disproportionate level of misconduct and toxicity, and under that presumption the demand to do that is higher than it would be if I was covering something else. That's my goal.
It's seeking attribution when you report something. That's
seeking
nice.
Attribution. And like, and that brings to mind like another issue. I think that has changed in the last like 15 years. If I was doing this job 15 years ago, there would be more of an incentive for people to give us comments on the record because they wouldn't have a Twitter account that they could reach their million followers with. But we would have an outlet that would be able to reach an audience that they can't just at the drop of a hat reach. But that's all gone now because everybody has an Instagram account or a Twitter account that they can reach far greater audiences than we ever could.
Yeah. And I think that just being really in the weeds of things, I think like there's still, I think more and more you're going to see people that are less incentivized to speak to media outlets because they have their own platforms. But in seeing that, like we can see when we are talking to these various sides, like you're getting widely divergent, presentations of their side. And I think it's our job to kind of being able to parse the facts here of like what is accurate, what is not, because you're not going to get that kind of objectivity when you're getting it straight from, you know, one person's vantage point.
And I think as well, like we talk a lot of negatives of the current landscape, but I think a positive, and there can be good aggregation and there can be bad aggregation. But, you know, I'll open up my phone now and there was a story, I can't remember, it was a couple of months ago, and just on the Google homepage, you know, it'll suggest things and wrestling copy and paste websites. And I know you've had good and bad run-ins with different websites that take your stuff, Brandon. But it was something that was quoting numbers that very clearly come from WrestleNomics.
Oh.
And I think for me, like, there's obvious negatives and that people will take your numbers and, you know, present them in a way that will present a great clickbaity headline. But there's a positive in there somewhere in that the work that you do and the work that WrestleTix does, that information is more accessible than it's ever been before. Yeah. And I think as a whole, I would hope that would lead to maybe, you know, if people are going to have these arguments, these entrenched arguments, more informed arguments, you know, more detail is there and widely available. So while there are all those negatives that you can pile on, I think there is something of a positive there, that information has never been more readily available.
I think like there are definitely talents that understand, especially like the value of like just hearing LA Knight the other day, and he's speaking about the fact of like Brandon always, he nails it when he states like there is no like scoreboard in pro wrestling. Like all you have are like these business metrics. And I think it's why wrestling kind of leans more towards that, because, you know, he brings up the fact of, you know, for 5 months in a row, I was a leading merchandise seller. And, you know, that is.
Did he say 5 months?
He said 5 months.
I'll have to check my records.
Yeah.
It's
good that those are exact numbers as well. There's no.
But he didn't say estimated either. So I was going to put the asterisk in there. But, you know, that like that is something where, like, if I'm a wrestler and I'm going and my contract is up, like, and I'm going in, and a Paul Levesque or a Nick Khan is going to say, this is what you want, why are you worth this? A branding can be a great, like, tool of, like, I kind of want that information to not just be verified, I want it out there. Like, that is sort of, I have very little leverage as a pro wrestler today. Even when you have a competitor in AEW, you're talking at a time when... like your value to bring revenue to a company is your greatest leverage, where losing you is worse than giving, you know, someone what they are, you know, commensurate with the performance that they are like. Match quality, very subjective, but numbers and analysis, like, that is the type of stuff that is can be very concrete and in their favor.
I'm aware of, I can say, I'm like, there are agents who are subscribing to WrestleOmics and who have, like, among other things, been like, why aren't the coder hours yet out yet? No, like, hang on, man. But yeah, they can use that data. They can use that data to try to make a better argument to the promoter about why their talent should get whatever contract. And it doesn't sound like in at least all cases, like, they have whatever data they want, right? It's not like you can go to WWE or AEW and they're going to give you the ratings data that you want to make the argument that you want. They're not going to help the agent, I guess, do their job in terms of negotiating a better contract for their client. And I'm aware of at least one case where they're looking at the merchandise estimates that I'm doing as part of, like, an argument about why this person is providing value. So I think it's a good thing too on related to that we're getting more information, I think, than I can remember at any time about, like, oh, so and so's contract is up at X date, so that maybe WB and AEW will know about this so that they can think about making them an offer or something like that.
I think it's like, again, I'm doing the wrap up here, but Sorry. It just, like, opens up all these other topics. But I mean, it's just like the flow of information in wrestling, it's just so weird, when especially when you're, like, reporting on this stuff. And I'm not, like, as active on, like, the breaking news as I was at a different period, but, like, the amount of times that I've heard wrestlers later in, like, these documentaries or stuff, and they're telling, you know, stories about, I got a heads up about this title switch or this match, like, the day of or something. And I'm just thinking in my head, it's like, I knew this before they did. And it's many times that has occurred. And it's just, you look at it, the flow of information, like, the talent or not, you just assume the talent is all in simpatico with creative. And that is, at least in my experience, is, like, not always the case. But I think for a lot, it's like, wrestling media is considered, like, this negative entity if you're a wrestler, and there's reasons for that publicly, but I think privately, there's a lot. Like, during the pandemic, most of the media, talent is getting, like, information about, like, what is going on, is this safe? There's all these different things where I think, for wrestlers, they have very little power and leverage, and media kind of, when done right, can provide some of that. Benno, is it true that you have a long-term goal of opening up a satellite office for Grapple in Thailand?
Oh, okay. What's your source on that one?
I can't reveal. I have heard this. I've heard this rumbling.
That's some good reporting. It could happen. Maybe Toronto. That's a possibility as well.
Might be converted.
Yeah, it might be. After spending a couple of weeks here, having a great time. Not quite with the poutine yet, but maybe I'll get there. I think it's interesting as well that, like, you look at, like, what's the future of this. I mean, I feel like doing this here with you guys, I picked up a few tips. So a bit more clickbait on YouTube, put some news behind the Patreon paywall. I think that can be the
Twitter blue check aggregation news. Don't use a link.
Right.
Never use a link. Always use an image. And who cares if you credit the source?
Post it and then block you. Yeah, that's a good block.
If I don't block you first,
we'll do that. But I think, you know, for the future for us in Grapple, I've made a couple of comments about fan media. It's like, I am fan media, but I do take that seriously, and I know other outlets like Voices of Wrestling and other places, you know, in a similar place to us. Like, I think a lot of the best wrestling media coverage comes from places that are people who aren't trained journalists or are people who are fans. I think it's definitely something we can offer in our little corner of the world. But we're just hoping to continue to grow, and hope that things pick up a little bit with AEW, might pick up our numbers. That might help as well. Hope on to the future. World domination, how about that?
And Steffi, how much on-site coverage are you looking at in the coming months? Is that something that's a priority for you?
Well, right now I'm trying to figure out exactly what I want to do. So it's been, like, a weird year in general. I think I am definitely very, I find it very hard to separate you know, they're watching wrestling and stuff, all the bad stuff that goes on. So, like, there was a period, like, around Christmas where I was definitely just, like, I want out of this industry, like, completely. And I changed my mind on that because I thought that if I feel a way, I should actually stick around and see what I can do. And then, obviously, I lost my job with Digital Spy a couple months ago. They were just like, budget cuts. We don't want wrestling anymore. They were like, feel free to pitch other stories as long as it's not wrestling. Like, goodbye. So that really sucked. So now I'm thinking what I want to do that will make me happy, because I loved doing interviews and for Digital Spy, but at the same time I felt kind of bad as well that it was like too frivolous. So now I feel, rather than being really sad about losing that job, that maybe I have an opportunity to create something that I want, especially with like the lack of women in the industry, and not just the lack of women, but there are definitely more women now, but the top people, like the people in charge, are men. And a lot of the time, from my perspective, they're men that are all friendly with each other. And I think the women maybe feel like they have to answer to them, or even like, I don't know, men are definitely in charge, right? So
there's too many of us.
But AEW has Madison Rayne and Sarah Stock as their agents. Don't worry.
And Dean Malenko is
Dean Malenko
told,
and Jerry Lynn.
I know. He did finally hire a woman writer, yes. But I'm not sure how that's going. Anyway.
Thanks for being here, by the way. We wouldn't have it done in this panel without you. So
but I had previously, like, I do have a Substack that I need to write more on, but that's kind of where I write about stuff that is that
you're
Digital
a really
Spy.
Great writer, Stephanie, by the
oh,
way.
Thank
like,
you.
Like, your writing is very strong. Like, it's it's to be something that really stands out.
So I want to focus more on that. That's where I would put stuff that no way Digital Spy would let me publish. Like, they wouldn't have. And then I want to get back to doing my podcast, because I was doing a podcast. I'm definitely going to change the name because everyone hates it, but it was called The Bechdel Hold. But that was the idea of, like, analyzing, like, wrestling and stories that are going on in wrestling just from a totally female perspective. So, yeah, I don't know. Look out for what I'm doing next, because I'm not 100% sure.
Wait, do you have any short-term goals?
No, not really. I just I want to have a great time at the wide open cash in. That's about it.
I want England to win on penalties. We're about to go to penalties.
I want England
to win. We're wrapping up at a good time.
I believe this is football. Soccer.
Yeah.
All right. That's going to wrap up the first, maybe of many, wrestling media summits. I want to thank all of you for sitting out here. Brandon, coming all the way from Buffalo in the rain to make it here. This was a lot of fun. I hope you guys enjoyed it. And I hope those listening on whatever outlets you're listening to enjoyed this as well. You can send me your feedback, but I probably won't see it. Goodbye.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. The hiring process can be slow and overwhelming. Simplify hiring with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. That's Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Terms and conditions apply.